Rick Lambert moved to Highland County for work in 1981 and liked it so much he never left. Why? Because, he says, it's the least populated county east of the Mississippi, and everyone waves at you, whether they know you or not. Rick's been caving most of his life.
My grandfather was a caver, so it started when I was 5 years old, and I'm 58 right now. And he started taking me caving, and my family owns 17 caves, and my grandfather at the time owned a commercial cavern. So I was brought up around caves and have been caving all my life. I have mud in my blood.
What was the commercial cave?
The commercial cavern was Seneca Caverns in Pendleton County, just the next county over, Rockingham. And the caves that he owned are in Germany Valley, which is the same valley that Seneca Caverns is in.
Now, you're a five-year-old. You're going into a cave with your grandfather. Look way back in time. What was that like? Were you scared?
Well, he carried a lantern because a carbide lamp or a caving lamp or a miner's lamp was too heavy for me to wear on a helmet. And he held me by the hand and watched me as if I could be swept away at any minute.
Was it weird? Was it scary at all?
Well, it wasn't scary because I've just grown up caving. But you get back far enough away from the daylight, and if your light goes out, you're in total darkness. But scary, no. The most dangerous thing in a cave are the people that are there.
What do you remember from those early, early cave adventures about the caves themselves?
They were wet, cold, and muddy. Now, the only difference today is the caves are still wet, and they're still muddy, and they're still the same temperature. It's just that our clothing has changed in the last 50 years. Instead of cotton, we now wear nylon and polypropylene underwear. So you're a lot warmer today than we were when I first started caving.
It's cold, it's muddy, and it's dark. Again, you as a five-year-old, you as a young kid, what was the appeal?
I think you'll find that most cavers are half a bubble off, so it's hard for 90% of the people in the world to understand the appeal. But it's the excitement of seeing something that maybe nobody else has ever seen. It's the excitement of what's around the next corner or the next bend. And you have to understand that when I was little, I'd go out hiking, and I was always looking for new caves. And I'm still doing that today, 50-some years later. And my desire is to find something new that nobody else has ever seen. I can't go into outer space. You know, I'm not going to be in the next mission to Mars. But I can go underground and see something today or tomorrow that no human has ever seen before.
You're serious about your caving.
Yes.
When did you start to get serious?
Well, initially I was a recreational caver, and we would have maybe five, six, seven caves that we would go to over and over again. And I finally reached a point that I wanted to give something back to caving. And at that point, I started project caving, which is different than recreational caving. It's very organized. We survey caves, make maps of them, record them, for groups like the Virginia Speleological Survey. And at that point, caving became a passion instead of a hobby.
A passion in what way?
Well, it's just about everything that I think of. It's almost everything that I do. I rarely spend money that doesn't lead to caving. My wife says that she's not my wife. She's my mistress, that I'm married to caving. It could be described as a sickness, like people that gamble. Well, I have to cave.
And is it still the sort of inner Star Trek in urging you to boldly go where no man has gone before?
And I think that describes it exactly.
That's it.
Yes.
It's like Everest, but they're there and you want to find them and explore them.
That's right.
Rick Lambert is not a spelunker. He's a project caver, and he goes underground with other project cavers to map and collect information.
In Germany Valley, which is in West Virginia, mm-hmm. we're working on atmospheric studies there. We have a cave system there that has, I believe, 73 or 4 holes that blow air. They blow.
Now, wait a minute. We got to stop and be sure we understand our terms here, that blow air.
Yes. At different times of the year, some caves will suck air in their entrance, and then the opposite time of the year, they'll blow air out. All these caves, by their elevation and the time of the year that they suck or blow, we can tell that they're tied together. It's two caves that are close together. They have probably 50 miles of passageways, and one day we're going to connect them and all the other 50 holes around them that are moving air, and we'll probably have a cave system close to 100 miles long.
You know they're connected not because you found the connector, but because of this airflow.
The airflow.
What causes, I think of a big sort of Gollum-esque thing in the cave.
Well, it's called
sucking and blowing.
It's called the chimney effect and the reverse chimney effect. In the summertime, warm air goes into the upper entrance of a big cave system, is cooled, and falls out the lower. And then in the wintertime, cold air goes in the lower entrance, is warmed, and rises out the higher entrance. So you have winter blowers and you have summer blowers.
If I were walking around in Germany Valley, could I go, oh, there's a blower? Would I feel it?
Oh, yes. Yes. At some of them, you can only tell that they're blowing with incense, and others you can see leaves or plants moving 10, 15 feet away. We have one that we named a noisy blower because we heard it before we found it. We heard the air exiting through a very small hole.
I want to talk with you about the scientific work that you're doing in caving, but first I want to talk with you about adventures that
okay.
you've had caving. Josh Rubenstein, who emailed me about you, told me to ask you about the bear.
There were 5 of us involved with the bear story. This was in Highland County on Game Commission property. And one of the people that was actually in the cave with me, his name is Larry Bear, and he was a Rockingham County caver. 5 of us had been searching a rock outcrop and some cliffs for some caves that had been reported there. Mm. And so I knocked a rock down on Larry and hurt him. And we found a cave entrance, and it was about a 12-foot pit. And Larry went down first. We set up a cable ladder.
Does that mean like a 12-foot well shaft?
Yes.
Sort of going down?
Yes.
Okay, 12 feet, boom, and you don't know what's down there.
That's correct.
Okay.
And so Larry went down, and he said, this cave smells like my wet dog. And I thought, okay, Larry's hurt. He's probably dehydrated. And, you know, men don't whine, but I thought, well, Larry's whining. And I said, just go on. It'll be all right. And he hollered back up. He said, quit knocking dirt down. There's dirt rolling down here. And we weren't moving. And finally I said, well, I'm coming down. We got down to the bottom, and it was a cave that went off in several directions.
Let me interrupt you again. Did you smell any of this wet dog smell?
Yes, I think I did. And when I arrived at the bottom of the cable ladder, I looked down one of the passageways, and I saw a dirt clod roll and didn't think anything of it. We took out the compass and tape and started doing the survey measurements. And we arrived down at the end of one of the passageways, and there were 3 rats' nests there that were flat. And I looked at Larry, and I said, Larry, did you step on these rats' nests? Because normally Larry's careful. He's a conservationist. And he looked at him, and he said, well, I must have. So I'm there at the rats' nest finishing my sketch of that passageway. And Larry puts his hand on my shoulder, and he says, Rick, I see a bear. And I thought, why is he doing this to me? I thought he was messing with me.
Is this winter or summer?
It's winter. So I kept sketching. And he grabs my shoulder with his hand, and he says, Rick, I see a bear. And I thought, uh-oh. My one goal is always to be the man that writes the accident report. And I jumped in front of Larry and put Larry between me and the bear. And when we reached the bottom of the ladder, we were up that ladder in seconds. What had happened is we had awakened the bear out of hibernation, and it backed itself all the way into the farthest passageway and was just looking at us and shuffling its feet back and forth, probably as much afraid of us as we were of it. And so that's the bear story.
You caved as a child, hanging onto Grandpa's hand. Then it developed into a passion.
Yes.
And now you are president of the Virginia Speleological Survey, which
That's correct.
Very scientific and important. What is this?
The VSS is the organization in Virginia that maintains the data on all of Virginia's 4,000 to 5,000 caves. And the reason we maintain it instead of the state is that our database is not subject to the Freedom of Information Act, as a state database would be.
Mm-hmm.
So when the state needs information, they come to us, we give it to them under contract, and when they're done with it, then they destroy it.
And what's the reason for this, that information,
well,
you don't want it to be public?
Every cave in Virginia is owned by somebody.
Okay.
And most of them are private landowners. And landowners vary in how they feel about their caves. Some landowners will say, come anytime you want, don't ask, just go. And others don't want to see you unless there's a scientific reason for you to be there. And what we're trying to do is protect the privacy of the landowners. Most of the caves don't have any significance. They don't have an endangered organism in them or maybe an endangered bat, but some do. And we're trying to, in addition to protecting the landowners, is protecting the organisms in the few caves that have them.
So it's just not going to have people tromping through them.
That's right.
Endangering a fragile ecosystem.
That's correct.
We've all been to commercial caverns. How do you, as a caver, feel about commercial caverns?
Well, my grandfather owned a commercial cavern, and I worked at it during the summertime when I was growing up. I think commercial caverns serve their purpose. That way, people that are not extremely claustrophobic can go see a cavern, and you don't have to go into a wild one. Or you can go into a commercial cavern and find out that caving is not for you. And one thing about most commercial caverns is they're very pretty. And most wild caves, you have hundreds or thousands of feet of just plain muddy walls and passageways, and then occasionally something pretty. And it seems like most caves that are commercialized, the pretties are concentrated.
Rick Lambert came to Highland County after 5 cave-free years in the Army and didn't start caving intensely until his children were old enough to go with him.
When they were little, I used to tie ropes around their feet and ask them to crawl into passageways that were too small for me to get into. And I'd always warn them, don't go down any pits and don't do this and all kinds of things. And one time I had a middle son, the last time that I did this, he crawled into a tight passageway that there was no way I could get in. And he wrapped the rope around a stalagmite. That's a formation that grows up from the bottom. And he made noises like something bad had happened. And I pulled on the rope and it didn't move. And that so filled me with fear, I never did it again.
What did he say when he popped out?
You know, I don't remember. I was so relieved to see him that I didn't get mad at him. It just became a funny story. But that was the last time I ever tied a rope around my son's leg and stuck him in a hole.
There's kind of a leap from walking around in a cave, looking at it, seeing what's there, exploring, and understanding the science of what's going on. How did you get to the science part?
I started first by wanting to survey caves and make maps of them. This is one of the ways the VSS documents its caves, or the caves in Virginia. We come in, we do a compass and tape survey, and at the same time, somebody is sketching the passageways, and you go back and you put all this information.
Just a freehand sketch.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And then you go back and you put the freehand sketch to the line plot that is produced from the compass and the tape. Then we also do biological inventories. We study the geology. We study the flow of the water.
But how do you know how to do this?
Oh, well, you learn it through the years, being with other people that do it.
You were sort of an apprentice in this system, and then you
learned it. That's correct.
Cool.
I had very good people that taught me what to do. we're working with James Madison University now, the geology department, especially Dr. John Haynes, in studying the geology in Highland County and in Germany Valley.
Is it pretty down there to you?
Sometimes. There are pretty parts in many caves, and then there are many caves that are not pretty at all.
Are they pretty to you?
Yes. To me, no cave is insignificant. I heard the Tennessee Small Cave Survey say one time that significant life, biological life, starts at about 16 feet. So you could have a new organism or a colony of bats in a small cave that's not pretty, but they're there. And they're significant, and in their own way, they're pretty.
Significant life that you're not going to find on the surface.
That's correct.
Wow. Do you have any idea how you turned out this way? Is it environment or heredity?
Probably heredity. Well, no, let's say environment, because my grandfather took me caving. My grandfather caved, my dad didn't. My children don't cave, but I do. And I'm hoping my grandchildren will cave.
You want to be that 90-year-old grandfather with the grandkid by the hand.
I hope so.
You'll find a caving link suggested by Rick Lambert on the Spark page at WMRA.org.